Oh, and a menu. Cheese bap, ham bap, pork pie or chips? Heston Blumenthal is quaking in his loafers. She stares at me and chews her gum.
Chips and a cheese bap, please,
Beth says. Same, thanks.
£10.60.
Say what you like about her attitude. Her mental arithmetic isn't bad. Beth starts to fumble in her bag. No, don't worry, I say. I'll get these. I reach in my pocket and frown. Shit. I've left my wallet at home.
No worries, Beth says. It's hardly going to break the bank.
I smile, feeling a little guilty, but only a little. We pay and find a seat. Not too difficult. In a corner near one of the windows. So, I say to Beth as she sips her Diet Coke, you were going to tell me about Hurst.
Right. Well, there's probably not that much to tell. The boy is smart, athletic, good-looking, and a sadistic little shit. And he gets away with it because of his dad.
Stephen Hurst.
You know him?
We went to school together.
Ah, right.
I hear he's on the council now.
Yeah.
And you know the sort of people that end up being councillors? People that genuinely want to help their community.
And arseholes that get off on being in a position of power and use it to further their own ends.
Gosh, I can't think which Stephen Hurst could be.
Yeah, he's a piece of work. But then you probably already know that. You've heard about the plans for the old colliery.
The council want to turn it into a country park?
Yep. Well, one of the reasons it has taken so long to get off the ground is because of Hurst.
How come?
Well, officially, because of difficulties with funding. Unofficially, Hurst has ties to a property company that wants to build houses on the land instead.
Housing? On an old mining site? That would take years for the council to approve. And then it hits me. Ah, I see.
Yep. Basically, Hurst Jr. is a chip off the old block. And Daddy is on the school board, so every time Jeremy does something that would get any other kid excluded, Hurst Sr. waltzes in, has a chat with Harry, probably about funding for the new sports centre, or the extra science block we need, and guess what? Nothing happens.
I feel a familiar anger start to stir in my gut. Same as it ever was, I think. Barmaid of the Year approaches again, brandishing our cutlery like weapons. She plonks it down on the table.
Chips will take a mo. We're out of ketchup.
Okay. She stares at me for a moment longer than is comfortable, and I wonder if saying okay has somehow offended her. Then she stalks away again. Beth looks at me.
You really do know how to make friends and influence people, don't you?
My natural charm.
Don't kid yourself.
I take a sip of Diet Coke, then I say, Julia Morton was Hurst's form tutor last year, wasn't she?
She nods. But I wouldn't read anything into it.
No?
No. Julia could deal with Hurst. She didn't take any shit, and he didn't give her too much. She was a tough cookie. She didn't crumble easily.
And yet she did, I think. She beat her own son to death. And why not use the gun? A moment of madness? Or something else?
As if she can read my mind, Beth says, that's why what happened just doesn't make any sense.
You said she was depressed.
She suffered from depression in the past.
But depression doesn't just go away. She'd stopped taking her medication. Maybe she had some sort of relapse, a breakdown?
She sighs. I don't know, maybe. And maybe if she had just killed herself, I could understand it, but to kill Ben? She doted on him. I'll never understand that.
What was Ben like?
Bright enough, plenty of friends, maybe a little easily led, That got him into trouble a couple of times. But a good kid. Until he went missing.
Ben went missing? When?
A couple of months before he died. Turned up after 24 hours, and after the whole village had been out looking for him.
Wouldn't say where he'd been.
It was out of character. Not like him.
I let this sink in. Missing. But he came back.
I never read anything about that.
She shrugs.
Kind of got swept under the carpet with everything else that happened. Anyway, afterwards, she pauses. He was different.
How?
Withdrawn, distracted. He stopped hanging out with his friends, so they stopped hanging out with him. This sounds awful, but he smelled like he wasn't washing. Then he got into a fight, hurt the other kid quite badly. That's when Julia asked for some time off and took him out of school. Said he was having emotional issues because of the divorce.
Why did no one else mention this?
Seriously? Who's going to say anything bad about a dead kid? Besides, everyone just blamed Julia for his behaviour. His mother was nuts, must be all her fault, right?
I think about that unnamed school source. I want to ask more, but right on cue, our charming waitress emerges back at the table.
Cheese, baps, chips.
Thanks.
She thuds the plates down and glares at me again. Sorry, I say. Is there something wrong? You're renting the Morton cottage?
Yeah.
You know what happened there?
This seems to be question of the week. Yes.
So what are you?
Sorry?
Some kind of ghoul?
No, actually, I'm a teacher.
Right.
She considers this. Then she reaches into her pocket, takes out a card, and holds it out to me. Not wanting to incur further wrath, I take it.
Dawson's Dustbusters.
What's this?
My mum. She's a cleaner. She used to clean the cottage for Mrs. Morton. You might want to give her a call.
Possibly the strangest sales pitch I've ever had.
Well, I'm not sure I can stretch to a cleaner right now, but thanks.
Suit yourself.
She wanders off again.
I look at Beth.
Whoa. Yeah, she's a little...
rude, weird, scary.
Actually, Lauren is on the spectrum, so normal social conventions can be difficult for her.
Right. And someone employed her as a barmaid?
You don't think every kid should be given an equal chance?
I'm just saying that the hospitality industry might not be the best career match.
Judgmental?
Practical.
Tomato, tomato.
Actually, it's tomato. I'm very judgmental on that one.
She grins. She grins a lot, I think. Makes me want to do the same. Use muscles I haven't exercised in a while.
Anyway, I say, sticking the card in my pocket, you were saying...
Nope. She jabs her fork at me. Your turn.
So why are you renting the Morton cottage?
You too?
Well, it is a bit weird.
It's convenient, it's cheap. And years ago it wasn't the Morton cottage. It belonged to a little old lady who used to throw scraps of bread to the birds and swear at the school kids who cycled past.
It's just a building.
It has history. Most places do. Although most places do not have an infestation of beetles in the waste pipes.
I fight down a shudder.
Beth regards me curiously.
So, talking of history, is it odd coming back here?
I shrug. It's always odd coming back to the place where you grew up.
Not being funny, but I can't imagine ever wanting to come back to Arnhill. As soon as I can, I'll be getting away.
How long have you been here?
1 year, 1 day and about, she checks her watch. 12 hours, 32 minutes.
Not that you're counting.
Oh, I'm counting.
Well, I know it's small,
parochial and a bit backward.
It's not that.
Then what?
Have you ever been to Germany?
No.
I went once, just after college. Had a friend working in Berlin. She took me to one of the concentration camps.
Fun.
It was a beautiful sunny day. Blue skies, birds singing. And buildings are just buildings, aren't they? But the place still had a feel, you know? Like it was in the very air, in the atoms. You knew a terrible thing had happened there, without even being told. Even while you walked around with the guide nodding and looking all sad, a part of you just wanted to run away, screaming.
That's what you think of Arnhill.
Nope. I'd go back to Germany.
She pops a chip in her mouth, then asks,
What's the deal with you and Stephen Hurst?
Deal?
I sense you two weren't exactly best buddies back in the day.
Not exactly.
Something happened.
I spear a chip. Just the usual teenage boy stuff.
Right.
Her tone implies she doesn't believe me, but she doesn't push it. We both chew our food. The chips are all right. The cheese bap tastes like plastic, if someone had tried to make plastic less flavoursome.
Harry told me Hurst's wife is ill, I say. She nods. Cancer. And whatever your feelings about Hurst, that's gotta suck.
Yeah.
And sometimes what goes around comes around.
They've been married a long time.
Teenage sweethearts. She looks at me. In fact, if you went to school with Hurst, you might remember her.
I went to school with a lot of people.
Her name's Marie.
Time slows and stills.
Marie? Yeah. Can't tell you her maiden name, I'm afraid.
She doesn't have to. Another chunk of my ground-down heart crumbles to dust.
It was Gibson, I say.
Marie Gibson. 9. Marie and I grew up on the same street. Our mums were friends, so we got thrown together a lot when we were small. Shooed off to play while they drank tea and gossiped. We played catch and hide-and-seek and sat on the curb and ate fabs and 99s when the ice cream van came around. This was before Annie was born, so I guess we'd have been about 4 or 5 at the time.
I quietly worshipped Marie.
She quietly tolerated me, the only other kid her age on the street. At school, she would quickly abandon me in favour of more popular playmates. I suppose I took this as my lot. Marie was pretty and fun. I was the weird, insular kid nobody liked. By the time we reached senior school, I had started to notice that Marie was a bit more than pretty.
She was beautiful. Her shiny brown hair, she wore it in pigtails when she was little, had been cut into a short, swingy bob. Sometimes she crimped it like a heroine, Madonna. She wore stonewashed jeans and baggy jumpers with sleeves that hung down to her fingers. She got her ears pierced twice in each lobe, and at school she rolled up the waistband of her skirt so that it hovered above her knees, revealing a tantalizing glimpse of toned flesh between the hem and her over-the-knee socks. Of course, by this point, Marie barely noticed me at all. She wasn't unkind or cruel, at least not on purpose. Occasionally she would walk past me on the street, and it was like she was seeing someone she vaguely remembered or couldn't quite place. She would offer a distracted, Hiya, and I would glow for hours at the acknowledgement. Annie used to tease me sometimes.
Oh, look, it's your girlfriend.
And make kissy-kissy noises.
Joey and Marie, sitting in the tree, K-I-S-S-I-N-G.
It was the only time I used to get properly annoyed at Annie. Perhaps because it hit a nerve. Marie was not my girlfriend. She would never be my girlfriend. Girls like Marie did not go out with boys like me.
skinny, awkward nerds who read comic books and played computer games. They went out with proper boys, who played football and rugby and hung around the playground spitting and swearing for no reason. Boys like Stephen Hurst. They started going out in the third year. In a way, it was sort of inevitable. Hurst was the village bad boy. Marie was the prettiest girl in school. It was just the way things were. I wasn't particularly jealous. Well, maybe a bit. Even then, I knew Marie was better than Hurst. Brighter, nicer, and unlike a lot of girls at our school, she had ambitions greater than to get married and have babies. When I found myself accepted into Hurst's gang, and Marie began to notice me again, she would tell me how she wanted to go to college and study fashion design. She was good at art. She dreamed of moving to London, planned to support herself with a bit of modelling. She had it all planned out. There was no way she was staying in a dump like Arnhill. As soon as she could, she would be on the first bus out. The one that got away. Except, she never did. Something changed. Something stopped her. Something tore her from her dreams, trampled those ambitions underfoot, and ground them into the dirt. Something kept her here. Or someone. I stand at the corner of my old street, staring up the road and smoking. I intended to walk straight back to the cottage after school, but it seems my subconscious has other ideas. The street has changed, and it hasn't. The same red brick terraces stand shoulder to shoulder, facing each other defiantly across the road, like they're squaring up for a fight. But there are new additions. Satellite dishes and skylights, UPVC windows and doors. More cars are bumped up along the narrow pavement. Shiny Golfs, 4x4s and Minis. In my day, not every family had a car. Certainly not a new one. Some things remain the same. A group of youths stand around a half-dismantled motorbike, smoking and drinking from cans of Carlsberg. A couple of dogs bark loudly and incessantly. Music drifts from one of the windows, heavy on bass, short on tunes or lyrics. A gang of young kids kick a ball about. My old house, number 29, is halfway along the street, a few houses up from the amateur mechanics, a few down from the wannabe Roonies. Of all the houses, it's the one that looks the least changed. The door is the same black painted wood I remember, although the old brass knocker has been replaced by a smarter silver one. The wrought iron gate still hangs a little lopsidedly. There are a couple of tiles missing from the roof, and the brickwork around the front could do with repointing. My room was at the back, next to Annie's. She got the box room, the shorter straw. When we were younger, we used to knock on the wall between us before we went to sleep. Later, after she came back, I used to lie in my room with my headphones on and the covers over my ears, so I wouldn't have to hear her. Mum sold the house soon after I came out of hospital, after the accident. Her excuse was that we needed somewhere that was easier for me, still hobbling on crutches, to get around. The narrow terrace with its steep stairs really wasn't practical. Of course, that wasn't the real reason. There were too many memories. Nearly all bad. Mum bought a small bungalow not too far away. We lived there together until I was 18. Mum stayed until the day they took her to hospital to die, just 10 years later, at the meagre age of 53. They said it was lung cancer. But that wasn't all of it. Part of Mum died the night of the crash. The rest of her just took a while to catch up. I turn away. The light is failing now, the air getting cooler, and if I lurk here much longer, there's a good chance someone might call the police. The last thing I want is to draw any attention to myself. I pull up the collar of my jacket and start to walk back down the street. There's a line people spout, usually people who want to sound sage and wise, about wherever you travel, you can never escape yourself. That's bullshit. Get far enough away from the relationships that bind you, the people that define you, the familiar landscapes and routines that tether you to an identity, and you can easily escape yourself. For a while, at least. Self is only a construct. You can dismantle it, reconstruct it, pimp up a new you. As long as you never go back. Then, that new you falls away like the emperor's new clothes, leaving you naked and exposed, all your ugly flaws and mistakes revealed for the world to see. I don't mean to walk back to the pub, but somehow that's the way I end up going. I linger outside for a few moments, finishing a cigarette, trying to convince myself that I am not going to walk inside. Definitely not. I don't need to start another school day with a hangover. I am going to go back to the cottage, make some food, and have an early night. I stub the cigarette out, congratulate myself on being so sensible, and walk inside. I can already tell that the pub is different from lunchtime. A lot of pubs are like that. They change at night. It's darker, the ancient fringed lamps providing dusty pools of illumination. The atmosphere is, if possible, even more unwelcoming. The smell is different too. Stronger, wheatier, and if I didn't know it was illegal, I'd swear people had been smoking in here recently. The place is also busier than at lunchtime. A few young men loiter around the bar, holding pints, despite the fact there are plenty of free seats. It's the possessive behaviour of the steadfast local, claiming territory, like dogs pissing on a tree. And I wouldn't be surprised if they had done that against the bar, too. The rest of the tables are filled by groups of older men and women. They hunch over their drinks like animals guarding a kill. The men sport signet rings, and rolled-up shirt sleeves revealing blurry grey tattoos. The women are all brassy streaks and crinkly arms poking out from ill-advised vest tops. I know pubs like this, and not just from my childhood. They might have been in bigger cities, fancied themselves as being a tad more sophisticated, but the clientele and the vibe are just the same. These are not pubs for family meals or a nice glass of chilled Chardonnay with your girlfriends. These are locals' pubs, drinkers' pubs, and in some cases, gamblers' pubs. I walk towards the bar, trying not to look as out of place as I feel. I might know these types of pubs, but here, despite growing up in the village, I am still an outsider. It's not quite the saloon bar door swinging open and the piano player falling silent, but I swear, for a moment, the general hubbub of conversation stills, and eyes crawl over me as I walk towards the bar. Little Miss Scary isn't serving tonight. Instead, a balding man with inky black bags beneath his eyes and several missing teeth scowls at me. What can I get you? Pint of Guinness, please. He starts to pour the pint silently. I thank him, pay, and, while the Guinness settles, I scan the room again. I spot a free table in a far corner. After he's topped up the pint, I walk towards it and sit down. I have my school books with me, so I take them out and do some marking while I sip my Guinness. Despite the staff, the lighting, the smell and the decor, the beer is well kept. It goes down quicker than I intended. I saunter back up to the bar. The barman is at the other end. He's obviously undergone some miraculous personality makeover and is smiling and laughing with the group of men I noticed as I came in. In fact, he's looking so gregarious, I wonder momentarily whether he has an identical twin. I wait. One of the young men glances my way and says something. The barman laughs louder and continues talking. I wait some more, trying to look relaxed, trying not to feel annoyed. He carries on talking. I clear my throat loudly. He looks over. The smile falls from his face and he lurches reluctantly across the bar towards me. As if pulled by an invisible magnetic force, two of the young men follow him. I hold up my empty glass. Thanks for finally doing your job. Another Guinness, please. He takes a glass and jabs it under the pump. I'm aware that the two young men have moved unsociably close. One is short and stocky with a shaved head and a sleeve of tattoos. The other is taller and skinny, with bad skin and the type of gelled hairdo I thought went out with white socks and two short trousers. They're not quite invading my personal space. Not yet. Just gathering on the border. I can smell the unpleasant aroma of stale sweat, only partially masked by cheap deodorant. Something about the pair feels strangely familiar, or perhaps it's just the threat of confrontation that I'm familiar with. I wait, watching the Guinness being slowly poured. And then I hear the shorter, stockier one say, "Not seen you in here before, mate." If there's one thing I hate more than being called man, is being called mate by someone who is not and never will be. I turn and smile. Only moved here recently. "You're that new teacher," Unwise Hare says. "That's right." I do love it when people tell me things I already know. "Joe Thorne," I hold out a hand. Neither takes it. "You're living in the old Morton cottage?" Again, the Morton cottage. Tragedy, especially bloody violent tragedy, stamps its identity on everything around it. "That's right," I say again. "Bit fucking weird, isn't it?" Unwise Hare has moved closer. "How do you mean?" "You know what happened there, right?" Stocky asks. "I do. Most people won't want to live in a place where a kid died like that. Unless they're weird," Unwise Hare adds, in case I haven't got the subtle subtext. "Guess I must be weird then."
"Are you being funny, mate?"
"I guess not." He presses closer.
"I don't like you."
"And I was about to ask for your number." I see him clench his fist. I grip the empty glass, ready to smash it on the bar if needed, and in the past, at least once, it has been needed. And then, when it seems that violence is inevitable, I hear a familiar voice say, "All right, lads, nothing wrong here, is there?" The Chuckle Brothers turn and melt away. A tall, burly figure walks up to the bar. Maybe I do believe in ghosts, I think. Bad ones that no amount of time, distance, or holy water will exorcise. "Joe Thorne," he says. "Long time." I stare at Stephen Hurst. "Yeah. Yeah, it is." 10. If some kids are born victims, are others born bullies? I don't know the answer. I do know it's not acceptable to say that these days. Not the dumb thing to suggest that some kids, some families, are simply bad. It's nothing to do with class or money or deprivation. They're just wired differently. It's in their genes. Stephen Hurst came from a long line of bullies. The joy of picking on those weaker was something that was passed down through the generations, like a classic heirloom or haemophilia. His dad, Dennis, was a foreman down the pit. The men loathed him, feared him, and loathed him some more. He wielded his power like a coal axe, cutting down those who opposed him, forcing his enemies on the hardest shifts, taking a delight in refusing leave to spend with newborns or ill family members. When the strike was on, he could be seen at the front of the picket line, waving his placard, hurling abuse at the working miners and stones and bottles at the police. I'm not saying all the pickets were in the wrong, nor would I ever judge those who went to work, like my dad. They both thought that they were doing the best for their families, to save their livelihoods. But Hurst wasn't on the picket line for his politics or his beliefs. He was there because he loved the confrontation, the aggravation, the ugliness, and most of all, the violence. It was never said at the time, but looking back I realized that it was probably Dennis who was behind the graffiti, the intimidation, the brick through our window. It was his style. Go for the soft target. Rather than attack Dad directly, he attacked his family. Stephen's mum often sported a black eye or a cut lip. Once, she had a cast that ran all up one skinny arm. Most people knew the injuries weren't down to her being a bit clumsy, but due to Dennis being a bit free with his fists after a pint or 10. But no one ever said anything. Back then, in a small village like Arnhill, that sort of stuff was between a husband and a wife. And their son. Stephen was tall like his dad, but he had his mum's fine features and blue eyes. Poster boy handsome. Pretty, even. He could be charming and funny too when he felt like it. But everyone knew that was a front. Stephen was a Hurst, through and through. Of course there was one big difference between him and his dad. While Dennis was a blundering thug, his son was not stupid. He was clever and manipulative, as well as being violent, brutal and sadistic. I had seen him force a kid's head down a toilet full of piss, make another eat worms, beat, humiliate, torture, mentally and physically. Sometimes I hated him. Sometimes I felt scared of him. Once upon a time, I would happily have killed him. And I was never one of his victims. I was one of his friends. The blonde hair is sparser, the once chiseled features softer, bloated by age and good living. He wears a polo shirt, dark blue jeans and two white trainers. Like many middle-aged men, he turns casual clothes into an oxymoron. He looks uncomfortable, more used to lording it in a suit and tie. He also looks exhausted. The two holidays a year tan cannot quite disguise the dark circles beneath his blue eyes or conceal the flaccidness of his skin, like worry is dragging it from the very bones. Surprisingly, this does not make me feel better. Over the years, I've wished many terrible things on Stephen Hurst. And now his wife is dying, and I don't feel any satisfaction. This may well mean I am a better man than I give myself credit for. Or maybe it's just the opposite. Maybe it's still not terrible enough. Maybe it means, as always, that life is unfair. Marie should not be the one being slowly eaten away from the inside by cancer. It should be Hurst. I'd say it was proof that the devil does indeed look after his own, if I didn't suspect that Hurst actually is the devil. We sit on opposite sides of the small, rickety table and regard each other appraisingly. My Guinness is half drunk. He has barely touched his whiskey. "So what brings you back to Arnhill?" he asks. "A job." "Simple as that, eh?" "Pretty much." "I have to say, you're the last person I thought would come back." "Well, things never work out quite like we imagine when we're kids, do they?" He glances down. "How's the leg?" "Typical Hurst, straight for the weak spot." "It bothers me sometimes," I say. "Like a lot of things." He regards me shrewdly. Despite the amiable act, I can still see the cold light in those eyes. "Why are you really back?" "I told you. A job came up. I'm sure jobs come up all over the place, all the time.
This one appealed to me.
You have a way of making bad choices.
Gotta be good at something.
He smiles, unnaturally white, completely false.
If Harry had informed me who he was interviewing, he'd never have got the job. Arnhill is a small village. People here look after their own. They don't like outsiders coming in causing trouble.
Firstly, I'm not an outsider, and secondly, I'm not quite sure what trouble I've caused.
The fact you're here at all is trouble.
Guilty conscience? No, wait. That would imply you had a conscience.
I see him shift, just a little, a reflex action. He'd like to punch me in the face, but he restrains himself. Just.
What happened here? It was a long time ago. Isn't it time you put it behind you?
Put it behind me? Like it was schoolboy hijinks or a first crush. I feel anger simmer.
What if it's happening again?
His face gives nothing away. Maybe he's a better bluffer than I am.
I don't know what you mean.
I mean Benjamin Morton.
His mother was depressed, had a breakdown. Worrying the type of people who become teachers, don't you think?
I don't buy it. I heard Ben went missing, not long before he was killed.
Kids run off sometimes.
For 24 hours. Like he said, Arnhill isn't a big village. Where was he?
I've no idea.
Do kids still play up on the old colliery site?
The eyes spark. He leans forward.
I know what you're implying. And you're wrong. It's nothing like...
He breaks off as an older man with a halo of white hair and brown flared slacks walks past and raises a hand.
All right, Steve. Not bad.
You here for quiz night tomorrow?
Or someone needs to whoop your ass again?
They laugh. The man wanders off to another table. Stephen turns back to me. The smile snaps off like someone flicked a switch.
I'm sure a man with your qualifications can find himself another teaching job somewhere better than this shithole. Do yourself a favor. Leave. Before there's any more unpleasantness.
Any more unpleasantness?
So he knows about the vandalism.
Tell me, I say, does your son own a moped?
You leave my son out of it.
Well, I would, but it seems that he has this unpleasant habit of throwing bricks through my window.
That sounds like slander.
I thought it was criminal damage.
I think we're done here.
He starts to push his chair back.
I'm sorry about Marie.
Something in his face changes. His lip trembles. One eye droops. For a moment he looks very old. And for the merest sliver of a second, I almost feel bad for him.
Must be tough. You've been married a long time.
Jealous?
Disappointed, actually.
I always thought Marie would leave this place.
She had dreams.
She had me.
Somehow he makes this sound like a burden rather than a reason.
And that was all?
What else could there be? We were in love. We got married.
Happily ever after.
We are happy. Probably difficult for you to understand. We have a good life here. We have Jeremy. We have a big house, two cars, our own villa in Portugal.
Nice.
It fucking is. And no one, especially not some third-rate teacher at some shitty school, is going to screw that up.
I thought the cancer already had.
Marie's a fighter.
So was my mum. Right until the end.
But that's not true. At the end, she didn't fight. She just screamed. The cancer that started in her lungs, nurtured by a 20-a-day Benson and Hedges habit, had spread to her liver, kidneys, bones, invaded everywhere. Even the morphine couldn't contain the pain. Not all the time. She screamed because she was in agony, and then, in those tiny moments of respite, she screamed because she was terrified of succumbing to the only thing that could take the pain away for good.
Yeah. Well, this is different.
Marie is going to beat the cancer. And those NHS doctors barely fucking old enough to shave. They don't know everything. He stares across at me, blue eyes blazing, cheeks flushed a deep red, spittle gathering at the corner of his lips.
They've said she's dying, haven't they?
No!
He slams his hand down on the table. The drinks jump.
I jump.
Marie is not going to die. I will not let that happen.
This time the pub really does falter and fall quiet. The very air seems to still. All eyes are upon us. Hurst must feel it too. After a moment, a very long moment, during which I half expect him to roar, tip up the table and wrap his hands around my throat, he glances around, composes himself, and stands.
Thanks for your concern, but, like your presence here, it's unnecessary.
I watch him go,
and that's when I feel it.
A sudden wave of dread, like vertigo, that hollows out my stomach from within and saps the strength from my bones.
I will not let that happen. It's happening again.
After Hurst has left, I finish my pint, more to prove a point than any real desire to drink more or stay in the pub. Then walk home. My leg does not thank me. My leg calls me a sadist and dumb moron, who should just swallow his pride and use his damn stick. It's right. Halfway along the lane, I pause and breathe deeply, massaging the lumpy, twisted limb. It's almost 9, and most of the light has faded from the day. The sky is a dusty grey, the moon a pale, naked shadow behind shifting curtains of cloud. I realize I have stopped beside the old colliery site. The remains of the reclaimed mine rise behind me, the dark humps of the old slag heaps like dormant dragons. It's a huge site, at least 3 square miles. New fencing has been erected this side, along with a sturdy padlocked gate. A sign attached to it reads, Arnhill Country Park, opening June. Bearing in mind it is now September, I would say this is optimistic at the very least. There were plans even when I was a kid to redevelop the area. All the old tunnels and shafts were supposed to have been filled in when the mine closed. But there were rumours this was done too quickly, corners cut, plans not altogether strictly adhered to. There were issues with subsidence, sinkholes. I remember a story about one that almost swallowed up a dog walker. Tonight, the area looks as much of a wasteland as ever. A dead, desolate place. One solitary digger sits halfway up one of the slopes, unmanned, seemingly abandoned. The sight of it still sends cold claws skittering down my spine. Digging into the land. Disturbing things. I turn away and resume my slow, uneven progress. I hear a noise behind me. A car is approaching along the lane, not too fast for once. In fact, it's really crawling. I glance round. Headlights blind me. They're on full beam. I raise a hand to shield my eyes. What the hell? And then I realize. The car pulls up and a voice says,
All right, mate.
Unwise Hare sits in the beaten-up Cortina next to his stocky mate who is driving. The lane is deserted. No other cars, no other houses. The cottage is still a good quarter of a mile away. There are two of them, in a car, and I don't have anything I could use as a weapon. Not even a damn walking stick. I tried to keep my tone even. I'm fine, thanks. Need a lift? No, I'm good. I continue lurching along. There's a crunch of gears, and the car crawls along beside me.
Got a bad limp there, mate. You should get in.
I said no, thanks.
And I said, get in.
I don't think you can afford my rates. The car squeals abruptly to a stop. Stupid Joe, really stupid. Sometimes it's like my mouth just goes out there looking for a fight. Or perhaps it's just trying to speed up what is bound to happen anyway. The doors open and they both climb out. I could try to run, but that would be pointless and pathetic. However, I'm not averse to a little begging. Look, it was a joke, mate. I just want to get home. Unwise Hare takes a step towards me.
This ain't your home. You're not wanted here.
Okay. I get the message.
No, you don't. That's why he sent us.
There is often an inevitability to life. Like I say, not fate exactly, but a sequence of events that are unavoidable. In the moment before the first blow strikes me in the face, I realize how stupid I've been. He sent us. These are Hurst's lackeys. That's why they slunk away like obedient pups when he walked into the pub. Then, when I wouldn't back down, he sent them after me. Same, I think, as another blow causes me to double over and fall to my knees, as it ever was. I curl into a ball and take a kick to the ribs. They erupt in fiery pain. I wrap my arms around my head. Sadly, I've been in this position before. If I could speak, which I can't because I'm trying to hang on to my teeth, I would tell these thugs that I've been beaten up by better hired muscle than them. That in the beating up stakes, they are amateur league. A kick thuds into my back. Fire shoots up my spine. I scream. On the other hand, even amateurs get lucky. I doubt Hurst will have told them to kill me, but it's a fine line. One I'm not sure these morons are capable of understanding the subtleties of. A boot connects with the side of my head. My skull explodes, and my vision wavers. And then, distantly, I hear something. A shout or scream. I am dimly aware of muffled curses. A cry of pain that is not, for once, my own. And then, to my amazement, the sound of doors slamming shut and a car accelerating away. I'd like to feel relieved, but I'm in too much pain and barely managing to grasp onto consciousness. I remain lying on the cold, hard ground, my body one throbbing mass of agony. It hurts to breathe, let alone move. My head feels worryingly numb. I also have a vague feeling that I'm not lying here alone. I sense a movement to one side, right or left. I can't tell anymore. I feel someone touch my arm. I try to focus on the face leaning over mine, swimming in and out of vision. Blonde hair. Red lips. And the last thing I realize before the blackness finally claims me is that I hope I'm dying. Because the alternative is far worse. 11.
The squeal of rubber-soled shoes on shiny linoleum. The smell of cabbage, disinfectant, and something else which the disinfectant can't quite mask. Feces and death. If this is heaven, it stinks.
I blink my eyes open.
Ah, you're back with us in the land of the living.
A vision clarifies in front of me. A woman, in doctor's scrubs. Tall and thin with short blonde hair and a strong face.
Do you know where you are?
I take in the thin blue curtain half pulled around the narrow bed, the harried-looking nurses hurrying past the end, the nearby cries and moans, and take a wild stab.
Hospital.
Good. She walks forward and shines a light into my eyes. I squint and try to move away as a fresh bud of pain blooms in one corner of my sore brain.
Okay.
I can smell her breath. Coffee and mints. She cradles my head, moves it from side to side.
And can you tell me your name?
Joe Thorne.
And the date, Joe?
6th of September, 2017.
Good. And your date of birth?
The 13th of April, 1977.
Good.
She draws back again, smiles. It obviously doesn't come naturally. She looks like someone who spends a lot of time being efficient, and the rest of it sleeping. But not enough.
Do you remember what happened?
My brain still feels fuzzy and tender around the edges. If I think too hard, it hurts. I was walking home from the pub and... the car. Hurst's thugs. And there was something else. A pause. I don't really remember.
Had you been drinking?
A couple of pints. The truth, for once. It all happened pretty quickly.
Okay. Well, you've obviously been assaulted, so the police will want to speak to you.
Great. Am I okay?
You've sustained severely bruised ribs and some more deep bruising to your lower torso.
Right.
You have some nasty abrasions and two impressive lumps on your head, but miraculously no fractures, and you don't seem to be showing any signs of concussion, but we'd like to keep you in overnight, just for observation.
She is still talking, but I'm not listening. Suddenly, it comes back to me. The figure looming over me. How did I get here?
A good Samaritan found you. A woman driving past. She saw you on the pavement, stopped and brought you here. You were very lucky.
What does she look like?
Petite, blonde, why?
Is she still here?
Yes, in the waiting area.
I swing my legs over the side of the bed. I have to get out of here.
Mr. Thorne, I really don't think it would be wise.
I don't give a shit whether you think it's wise or not. A small flush on her pale, drawn cheeks, then a nod. She flicks the curtain open and stands to one side.
Very well.
I'm sorry, I...
No, your call.
You're not going to stop me?
A tired smile. If you're well enough to walk out of here, there's not much I can do.
I promise I'll try not to drop dead.
She shrugs. Between you and me, we've got more beds in the morgue anyway.
I use the bathroom. Splash some water on my face. It doesn't do much to wash away the dried blood, but it does make me feel a tiny bit more human. Then I limp slowly back out into the corridor. It's a big hospital. Lots of ways in and out. I turn away from the signs directing me to the main exit and head inwards, into the maze of bluey-grey corridors. Eventually, I see another sign for north exit. It will do. It takes me a while. My bruised ribs protest at just about every breath. My back feels like someone has inserted a hot spike at the base of my spine, and there is a constant dull ache in my skull. Still, it could be worse. She could have found me. I reach the north exit and push open the doors. The night air greets me with an icy slap around the face. After the suffocating warmth of the hospital, it sends my body into a paroxysm of shivers. I stand for a moment, trying to contain them, gulping in the freezing air. Then I take out my mobile phone with trembling hands. I need to call a taxi. Need to get back to the cottage before... And that's when the truth strikes me with a dull, hollow thud. If she is here... If she was driving along Arnhill Lane this evening, then she already knows where I live. I lower the phone, just as I hear the rumble of an engine. And I know it's her, even before the sleek silver Mercedes pulls up in front of me and the window slides down. Gloria smiles at me from the driver's seat.
Joe, sweetheart, you look terrible. Hop in. I'll drive you home.
There's a moment, most addicts know, when you realize that your vice, whether it be alcohol, drugs, or, in my case, gambling, has become a real problem. My moment of enlightenment came when I met Gloria. In fact, you might say that Gloria saved me from myself. Up until then, I think I had just about been able to pretend that it was all still a hobby, a game, a distraction. Despite losing my job, my friends, my savings, my car, and pretty much every night to the lure of the green baize and the crisp shuffle and flip of the cards, I had it under control. Funny how the biggest bluffs are the ones you pull on yourself. My grandparents taught me to play cards. Gin Rummy, Pontoon, Newmarket, Sevens, and... finally, poker. We played for pennies, which they kept in a big glass jar. Even at age 8, I found it fascinating and addictive. I loved the faded, swirly red pattern on the backs of the cards, the different suits, the two-faced ace. Now I'm high, now I'm low. The imperious kings and queens, and the slightly sinister, caddish-looking jacks. I loved watching my granddad deal, flicking out cards as fast as lightning with his yellow calloused fingers. Fingers that looked rough and clumsy, yet could be so dexterous and light with a pack of playing cards. I tried to copy the shuffles, the cuts, the sleight of hand. Some of my happiest times as a child were spent sitting at the chipped formica table in their tiny grease-stained kitchen, a glass of flat cola in front of me, stout for my granddad, lager and lime for Nan, staring at our cards as their cigarettes burnt down to the filters in the ashtray. I taught Annie some of the same games. Mum and Dad never had time to play, so it wasn't quite the same. You usually needed a minimum of 3 people, but we still whiled away many rainy afternoons playing Snap or Patience. After the accident, I stopped playing. I concentrated on my studies. Decided to enroll in teacher training. I liked English. It seemed a decent job, one that might even make my mum proud. And perhaps a part of me thought that it was a way to do something good. To help kids and make up for all the stuff I'd done wrong as a kid myself. To my surprise, I was a good teacher. There was even talk in one school of promotion, head of year, progression to deputy head. I should have been happy, at the very least content, but I wasn't. Something was missing. There was a void inside me that nothing, not work, friends or girlfriends could fill. Some days, my whole life felt unreal. As if reality had ended when Annie died, and everything since had just been a bad copy. Somewhere along the way, I picked up the cards again. I would usually find some like-minded acquaintances to play a few hands in the pub after work. Light drinkers or the gamblers managed to seek each other out. But soon the friendly games, betting pounds or fivers, weren't enough. I met a man. There's always a man. A game changer. A devil who appears at your shoulder. I was getting ready to leave one night, a little worse for wear, when one of the regulars, a thin, pasty individual whose name I never knew or asked, motioned me over and whispered, "Fancy a proper game?" I should have said no. I should have smiled, pointed out that I was already late and had to work in a few hours, not to mention